As I was coming here, somebody asked me, so what's going to happen in 2012? And my immediate sort of off-the-cuff response was nothing. Which I probably should have modified to not much more than what's happening now. As soon as people hear a date, we get fixed on that date, you know, December the 21st, 2012. It's like, come that day, everything's going to happen. That's going to be the time when the great transformation, renewal, the collapse of everything, whatever it is, it's like it's going to be on that day. I don't think much is going to happen on that day. There may be some, you know, celebrations at holy sites around the world where people are gathering to celebrate the solstice of 2012 and waiting for the end of the world to happen. I was actually looking yesterday, just out of interest, to be even more precise, when is the solstice? It's actually at 11:11, which is something that probably happens once in every 1,000, 1,500 years. The solstice is actually on that time, 11:11. So all those people who are so caught up in 11:11 are going to have a whale of a time. The solstice of 2012 is on 11:11. Hey, couldn't be much better than that. And maybe that's just part of the wonderful cosmic choreography. I think, you know, whoever organizes this whole show is having a wonderful little laugh to itself about what's going on. And then I was thinking the actual date, you know, if you write the date out, it's 1-2-2-1-1-2-1-1-1-1. It's like, nice. It's not just some random string of numbers. And I love that stuff. Perhaps it's being a mathematician originally. I love playing with numbers and seeing patterns in numbers. Not to read any great significance into it, except there's a subtle beauty, there's a game going on there underneath, which it's nice to enjoy. And there may even be people going to be sitting around at 11, waiting for 11 minutes past 11 on the 21st for the moment to happen. And so I think it's just going to pass, that moment will pass unnoticed. Or even the year. I mean, people are going to start expecting change come January the 1st of 2012. The point is, it's not about a moment in time. And this was something John was pointing to. It's about the times, the period of time. And John was talking about, you know, the sun crossing the center of the galaxy, the ecliptic, the solstice. That's the point when the center of the sun crosses the center of the galaxy. But from the moment the top of the sun, or at the top of the sun, starts crossing the center of the galaxy and the bottom of the sun does, that's a period of about 36 years. So there's a period of 36 years when the sun is crossing the center of the galaxy. And we're in that period now. And if you want to be exact, that began, whatever it was, 1994 and go on to 2030. So that's a sort of a period of time. Or we could make it, I mean, I like to think it probably appeared more like 100 years. I don't think the Mayan calendar was saying, you know, at that particular day, it ran its full circle. And as it came to an end, we're entering these times. If you take a 100-year period, I just think it's interesting. If you take a 100-year period, then 50 years ago would have been 62, the beginning of the 60s. And I think most of us can see, particularly those of us who are alive and thriving in that time, that really was the beginning of a whole movement towards renewal. That was when collectively, well, not collectively, totally, but a large proportion of the population in the West began to see that the old way of running society, the old politics, the old way of interacting didn't work, and something new needed to happen. And there was that vision which came in the 60s. And interestingly, I mean, psychedelics have been part of a theme here, both in terms of the indigenous cultures who saw these things and people's experiences. It clearly was fueled by psychedelics, the 60s. People were stepping out of their ordinary reality, tasting other realities. And if it hadn't been for that widespread use of psychedelics, maybe that vision would not have happened, or it would have been much more muted. And probably the bit that always stands in my mind was 67. Those who lived through it, we always celebrate the summer of 67. Something happened then as a moment in time, or as a little period in time, which ended with the Beatles singing All You Need Is Love, which interestingly was the first ever live global satellite broadcast. It was them recording that in the studio, or re-recording it. They actually did a studio recording, then they did the live recording. Which I found interesting. And that's the vision. It's true, it's still true. All you need is love. If we could just live with love in our hearts as a permanent reality 24 hours a day, we wouldn't be in this mess. If we were all living with love in our hearts, we'd be treating each other very, very differently. We'd be treating other peoples very, very differently. We'd be treating the environment totally differently. And so that was the vision, and I think in the years since then, nearly 60 years since then now, or 50 years since then, it's like, how do we do that? That's the challenge. How do we actually live with love in our hearts? And that's the spiritual journey which I want to be talking about as one of the things. What I want to do today is pull together many threads of what I see happening at this period in history. And for me, 2012 is like the epicenter of this. You know, an epicenter, we're all familiar with epicenters of earthquakes. And the word epi is important because it means sort of roundabout here. You know, an earthquake doesn't have an actual center, but there's sort of an area where the earthquake is centered, and it's like, it's coming out from somewhere around there. So when they say, you know, the epicenter of this earthquake was this particular village or something, it's just that's sort of where it was centered, but there's no actual point. And as you get further away from that epicenter, so the vibrations get less, but you can still feel them maybe 100 miles away, 200 miles away, and you can record them with instruments across the planet. So I see 2012 as like an epicenter in time. Something was a cultural earthquake that's happening. It's the epicenter of a cultural earthquake. And the closer we get to that time, the more the crisis is going to deepen, and also the push towards change, transformation is going to increase, that pressure is going to increase. So we're getting closer and closer to the epicenter of the change. And as we move beyond the epicenter, that change is going to keep reverberating. And as with an earthquake, there's no sort of final limits to it. I think the same with 2012. And it's interesting what John pointed out yesterday, that maybe this began on the summer solstice, when the summer solstice sun crossed the center of the galaxy, which was 12,000 years ago at the opposite point, was when maybe the seeds of the decay began to, or seeds of the, not decay, but the falling into the crisis slowly began to happen, and it's been deepening and deepening and faster and faster and faster as we approach this point. So that's how I see 2012 as a sort of a period in history with no discrete boundaries, but something we are clearly heading into. We are in a period of crisis, clearly. It's been alluded to, referred to several times here, and I don't think we need to go into any of the details about that. We all see that. It's in the news. There's numerous international conferences looking at different aspects of it, whether it's the global warming or resources or deforestation, pollution, water. I was at a conference recently where they laid out 21 different aspects of the crisis, all of which were absolutely critical to the continued survival of humanity or continued survival of Western civilization. Some may be critical to the survival of humanity. But we're in this crisis. But it's been a long time coming. And I think many of us have been aware that it's going to hit us sooner or later. And even with the economic banking crisis we're with at the moment, people are acting with total surprise on television. Oh, the system's flawed. Wow. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've been aware that this has been coming most of my life, and talking to people. And any economic system that's based on the charging of interest has to collapse eventually. All the great religions have seen that, which is why they, one time or another, they banned the charging of interest. We've seen this coming. And I mean, even more recently, I mean, people I know have been reading papers and things where about 18 months, 2 years ago, people were saying, okay, now's the time it's going to happen, when people started seeing what was going to happen with the subprime mortgages and the ramifications of that through the credit system, through the banks. It's been obvious it's coming. And finally, we're here, or this phase of it is here. And the same thing with energy, oil. Global warming was first forecast over 100 years ago. People didn't take much notice of it then. Oh, doesn't matter. Won't be that serious. But it was forecast then. So I think it's been coming really for thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. I think humanity was... this is its destiny of humanity, to come to this point in time where it has to wake up and make a shift in consciousness. And it comes from a unique characteristic of human beings, which is the fact we are an intelligent species, and I believe there's many intelligent species on this planet, the dolphins and whales particularly, but you know, some of the other mammals, I mean, elephants have an incredible intelligence, memory, they can recognize themselves. What's unique about human beings is we have this little tiny thing. The thumb, the fully opposable thumb, which we can put in opposition to each finger. A chimpanzee can't do that. It can't rotate its thumb. It can't touch its little finger. It can do that. It can grasp things. But this gives us ability to manipulate in very fine ways. And you combine that with intelligence, and you're off on this fateful track. Dolphins and whales have been around probably 20 times longer than we have on the planet. But their thumbs are neatly sealed up safely inside their flippers. You look at the skeleton of a whale or dolphin, they're there, they've got their four fingers and a thumb, but they're safe. They can't do anything with them. They can just use them for steering their way through the water and flapping and splashing a bit, but they can't start building underwater freeways and fish farms and all that stuff. As soon as we started making tools, we began this journey to this point. Because we started breaking away from we changed our relationship to nature. The first thing that probably broke that relationship was the spear. Being able to throw something, a spear, and kill an animal at a distance. Before then, we were like any other animals. We could eat other animals, capture them, but only when we actually physically caught them. Suddenly we could catch animals at a distance. And it's interesting that there's correlations with the disappearance of the great mammals, the mammoths and those things, are correlated with when human beings started hunting with spears. We could go and capture those big animals. And then the development of the seed, agriculture, being able to plant the seed, again changed our relationship to nature. We could begin to do good things like produce crops, hoard them through the winter, see ourselves through difficult times. All of this was done with the best of intentions to make life easier and better. Fire. Fascinating how once we developed fire, that was a good thing. We could cook food, keep ourselves warm in the winter. But we started raping the planet then. I mean, wood was the first major fuel, and then that got exhausted. It's fascinating, you know, in current times we get all these pictures of the Middle East and Iraq and those areas. Just remember a few thousand years ago, We talk about the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. You know, where are the Hanging Gardens in Barak, in Baghdad? Barak, where did that come from? Shows how the mind is going. Anyway, we took down major areas of forest for wood, for burning, for the kilns. All that pottery required wood. And then we moved on to coal and oil. It's all been increasing as we've gone along. And behind it all has been a mode of human consciousness which we've got sucked into, which says, if you're not happy, if you're not at peace, if you're not feeling okay, do something about it. And this is our doing instrument, our hands. Manipulate the world, change the world in some way. Go and get something, make something different, get some new experience. And that was probably okay in the past. Before the Industrial Revolution, that was probably the appropriate way. If then you were suffering, it was probably because you were cold, wet, hungry, thirsty. Who knows, but probably you were suffering very often because there was something physically amiss and you needed to go out and do something, stoke the fire, whatever it was, to relieve the suffering. We live in a totally different world now. You know, few of us suffer because we're thirsty or cold. We just, you know, go to the refrigerator, get some nice cool water if we're thirsty, or adjust the central heating, put on some nice clothes, whatever it is. If we're suffering, it's because there's something in our mind that tells us things aren't the way we think they should be for us to be happy. And so we get caught in this mode of interacting with the world where we're continually thinking, if only I could just get the world right, I'd finally be happy. And it doesn't work. We can temporarily get the world right. We can find some temporary satisfaction. We go shopping and feel good. I don't know, how long does shopping make you feel good for, those who are into retail therapy? How long's the fix last? Till you get your bill, okay. And then you need another fix. But that's the mode we're caught in. And that's what drives so much of our society, the consumption. It also blinds us to what we're doing to the planet. It's why we love money so much. I mean, there's no point. I mean, money itself is nothing to love. Bits of dirty paper and few electrons in a computer somewhere. But it gives us the power to, the opportunity to get the things we think will make us happy, or the relationships, the friends, the experiences. So our consciousness has got totally caught up in this. It's been there all along, as I say. As soon as we started manipulating the world, we started falling into this trap, this mental trap. And what's happening now is the errors in that thinking are coming up to meet us everywhere, everywhere. And we're just beginning to see that that's what it's about. And it's fascinating, the economic crisis that's been unfolding in the last 2 weeks is probably the first crisis that has really made it clear that it's something in our own thinking, in our own society, that's actually creating the problems. Before, we could always put it out there, you know, well, hurricanes, they're going to happen anyway, and global warming, we don't know. We can push it away, all the other things. Wars, we can always blame the other people. They're at fault, we had to go and defend ourselves, or whatever it is. But this, the economic crisis, is fascinating because it's clearly coming from the greed, the short-sightedness, the self-centeredness of people in our own culture. Of course, we can say it's them. but it's also every one of us who has shares in companies hoping that the price will go up, gambling as we do. It's all of us, I mean, but it's coming home, that it's something in our consciousness. That's the root of the problem, and I think that's going to get clearer and clearer and clearer. And as it does, it's going to push us more and more into this thing of how do we actually shift consciousness? How do we awaken human consciousness? How do we step out of that old way of thinking? And I think that's what the spiritual traditions have been about over the years. Really, for thousands of years, there have been people who, in one way or another, through grace, good teaching, who knows, maybe traumatic experiences or wonderful, blissful experiences, one way or another, they've stepped outside of that normal, self-centered, ego-dominated way of functioning into what I call natural mind, the mind that's uncluttered by the fears, the wanting, the hoping, all that stuff. And that's the direction I think we have to move. And it's happening, and I want to talk about that more later, some of the indications of what's actually happening here on a deeper level of this awakening. It's coming sort of behind the crisis, but it's really been growing in our culture, I think, since the 60s. That's when we started taking a new look at spirituality. Before then, for almost everybody except for maybe a very few people, we were linked into the religion in which we were brought up in. Depending on your culture, but we were brought up in a religion, and that was spirituality. And we started seeing, hang on, there's more to spirituality. In fact, spirituality is not religion. I think that's what people began to realize. Spirituality, for me, is that awakening to the true reality, the true nature of our mind, which happens in those mystical experiences. And spiritual growth is about how do we integrate that other reality into this life. And there have been numerous people dotted throughout history who've had that experience in one way or another. And many of them, having had that experience, want to share it with others. It's natural, you know. Hey, life could be so much easier. It's different. Everything shifts. So let me tell you, you know, how I got it or how what happens. And so you have, let's call them enlightened. I don't like the word, but we're doing. Awakened is a better word. Awakened people sharing their experiences with less awakened people. And they sort of get it, some of it. Maybe not hear other bits, forget bits, misinterpret bits. And they go on, the disciples teach other people, other disciples, and they teach other disciples. At each stage, it gradually a bit gets lost. It's like, you know, taking a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. Gradually, it deteriorates, the quality of the message gets lost. And you do that over several hundred thousand years, hundreds or thousands of years, and do it from one language to another, take it from one culture to another. And it ends up often totally the opposite of what the teacher was originally saying. That's religion. I sometimes call it truth decay. Or more accurately, the entropy of knowledge. In entropy in physics is how leave things alone and gradually they decay. I think it's the same with knowledge. Just once it's separated from the source, and the source is our inner knowing, once it just becomes an understanding that's passed on, then that decay sets in and you have religion. And I want to come back to that more. But before that, I want to look at another trend, another long-term trend that's going on, which is the whole acceleration of change. And that's both in terms of evolution, our own development, it's the deepening of the crisis. I think the crisis is accelerating. And the awakening is accelerating, but there's this pattern of acceleration. And we see it in our own lives. I mean, just how much faster the pace of life seems today than it was 20 years ago. I mean, just emails. In the quote old days, the good old days, it's always the good old days when life was slower, things were more relaxed. The good old days, you wrote a letter, put a stamp on it, put it in the post, probably arrived there a day or two later, they read it and got down and wrote a reply, put in an envelope, put a stamp on it, came back to you, probably a week later. Now, you know, you send an email and you get somebody, or someone sends you an email, and the next thing you know is you got a phone call. Why haven't you answered my email? I sent it to you 15 minutes ago. And just, you know, the new technologies that are coming down. We're being forced to adapt and change faster and faster and faster. You know, the pace of life 100 years ago, as far as we can tell, was much more gentle. 1,000 years ago, gentler still. But this is a pattern that's been going on throughout the evolution of life. I mean, from our current understanding, the planet came into existence about 4.3 billion years ago. About 500 million years later, life appeared, which itself is interesting in the bigger picture. Life seemed to appear on this planet, the very first living systems, almost as soon as the planet had cooled down enough for life to be possible. Which goes in the face of, you know, all these calculations that say it required all these combinations and everything, and life, you know, it's almost impossible life could have evolved in this time. So you either have to postulate it was planted here by some great being, or the current theory is that was the theory of panspermia, which is that spermia meaning the seeds of life are everywhere. Pan means in all, everywhere. And we're beginning to find them out there in space now and in the comets. And so the most likely explanation is life was seeded on this planet by comets coming in with the very basic molecules that were needed. And the water. It's a big question of where does all the water on the planet come from? In fact, planets are ice balls, and the rate of fall the rates of fall of comets onto the planet just about accounts for all the water on the planet. So, anyway, that's an aside. So life came somewhere about just 3.8 billion years ago, the first living systems. And very simple cells for about half the history of life on Earth. And they gradually grew into more complex cells. And then, about 1.5 billion years ago, they started forming into multicellular organisms, simple creatures. And then something like 100 million years ago, we had the first nervous systems, vertebrates forming. And then mammals, probably 50 million years ago or so. The first ones were probably before that. The mammals were living at the time of the dinosaurs. It was after the dinosaurs became extinct that mammals really started flourishing. But we're talking here about the last 1% of Earth's history. Mammals appeared, the last 1% of Earth's history. And then human beings, Homo sapiens, is the last 1% of mammalian evolution. So you can see I was getting faster and faster. And then civilization, as we think of civilization, coming together in towns, cities, that's the last 1% of Homo sapiens. So the whole thing's getting faster and faster and faster. Now, you know, the information revolution is just, whatever, however you want to count it, but it's decades old. The industrial revolution just few hundred years old. So you can see how it's been going faster and faster and faster and faster. And it's going to keep on getting faster and faster. And there's the reason for this is fairly straightforward. It's what's called feedback in a system. And so each new level of evolution actually facilitates the next steps of evolution. And a classic example of that was how life moved from asexual reproduction to sexual reproduction about halfway through the history of life on Earth. Asexual reproduction, just to remind you of your biology lessons in school, is one cell splits into two cells, and that splitting, each cell has the same genetic information. Then those cells split, and life just goes on by cells dividing. Each one being a clone, you have two clones, two sister cells, and then they clone themselves. And genetic changes happen through various things, whether it's whatever it is. It could be radiation, could be chemical things. Evolution is slow. Sexual reproduction is the opposite. Two cells come together with different genetic information, mix up their information, share it, and create a new cell with a new set of DNA. And that goes on, meets another cell with another new set of DNA. That speeded the rate of evolution thousands of times. And that's one reason why the whole spurt in the second half of life on Earth happened, because sexual reproduction made things much, much, much faster to evolve. Same with multicellular organisms. You don't need to start changing the cells, you change the organization of the cells. Like, you know, take ourselves as mammals. Most of the cells in our body are very similar to the cells in a dog or a pig, the heart cells. That's why we can transplant things. It's the organization, the higher level of organization, that makes us a different creature with different capacities. And that organization can evolve much faster than evolving a whole new cell. So it's that process of building on previous levels that makes it go faster. And you can see the same thing in human society. In the Industrial Revolution, we learned how to mass produce things, distribute them. So when the Information Revolution comes along a couple of hundred years later, and we want to start producing information technology, computers, satellites, whatever it is, we don't have to go back and reinvent material production or distribution. It's there. We just plug it in. And so that's one reason that can happen much faster. And now that the internet's established, what's going to be riding on the back of the internet, something else I want to touch upon, that's going to happen much faster still. So it's inevitable, this speeding up. And add to that, with human beings, we actually try to make things go faster. If you think about it, just about every single invention we've come up with that's stuck is something that's actually made things more, quote, efficient. Efficient means getting more done with less energy or more done in less time. We want things to happen faster. You know, that's why we build new freeways, make better machines. It's all about how can we get things done faster. You know, the latest operating system boots up in 25 seconds as opposed to 38 seconds. It's faster. We're trying to make things go faster. So there's this whole evolutionary trend towards speeding up. And on top of that, we're saying, yeah, look, faster, faster, faster. So it's inevitable that the future's going to get even faster, which has several implications. Firstly, it makes it very, very hard to predict where we're going to be in the 10, 20 years' time. I mean, how many of us predicted, where are we, 15 years ago, even less. Probably say 15 years ago, most of us hadn't heard of the internet. We'd heard of the internet, but not the World Wide Web. It only formally came into being in 91. And then was very simple, just text. It started coming into the public awareness around 95. Which is when we started getting graphic browsers, the things we're so used to today, 13 years ago. How many of us saw then that we'd be streaming television, shopping, sharing videos, doing all the things we do on the internet then. Very few of us. We didn't imagine it was going to be like this. And given that it's speeding up, I don't think any of us, very few of us, can imagine where it's going to be in another 10 or 15 years. We've really no idea what's going to be happening. We can see the trend, see where it's going. And what is clear is if things keep speeding up, it's heading towards what some people call a singularity. And there's two sorts of singularity I want to just touch on. The word is popularized by people like Ray Kurzweil, who wrote a book, The Singularity Is Near, and other books before that. And what he saw, and what many people have seen, he was really just pulling together what many people have seen, is the way information technology is accelerating. We have something called Moore's Law, which was mentioned, I don't know, was it you, John, or Daniel? Someone mentioned Moore's Law, which is that computer processing, computer speed, computer memory, these things are all doubling every 12 to 18 months. And that's why, you know, the computers we have today, our laptops, are far more powerful than the computers I was playing with, which filled a room when I was at college. The average laptop now is far more powerful than that. And if you extrapolate that trend into the future, then somewhere around 2025, we get computers that can do everything that human brains can do and better. We start getting computers that are better than the human brain. That's the extrapolation. And that's what Kurzweil and people call the singularity. The word singularity comes from mathematics, and it's a term that's applied when the normal equations break down. And a very simple one is, if you imagine the Earth, you can keep traveling north until you get to the North Pole. It's the only place on the planet you can't go north from. You can only go south from the North Pole. You can rotate to the east or west, but you can't go anywhere except south. It breaks down. The old measurement, the old sort of north, south, east, and west breaks down at the North Pole. There's only south. It's the only place you can go from the North Pole. Or one that's, I'm sure, also familiar to you, you can divide by any number except zero. You can divide by 1,000, by 1,000,000, by 1,000,000,000, by 1,000,000,000. Or you can go smaller and smaller numbers. You can divide by a tiny, tiny bit. But you can't divide by zero. The mathematics breaks down. That's called a singularity. And so Kurzweil took that term singularity, saying when we have computers that are as good as human beings, the whole pattern of history breaks down. We don't know what's going to happen beyond that. And we don't know, there's suggestions that maybe we'll have a symbiosis of human beings and computers. Maybe computers will take over. Maybe we'll download our consciousness into computers. I think that's a huge maybe. I think people who think that way, I think they don't have any recognition of what consciousness is really about. It's still this sort of feeling that consciousness is somehow something produced by the human brain. And when we get computers as good as human brains, then they will produce consciousness. I don't think consciousness is produced by the brain at all. But the brain influences what happens in consciousness, but it doesn't create consciousness. But that's a whole other talk. So that's the model of singularity that's often talked about. But there's another singularity that we're heading towards. If you look at this curve, we've got this sort of this pattern of acceleration. Kurzweil and people are pointing to a point here when the 2025 point, whatever it is, when computers become super conscious, super intelligent, not conscious. Excuse me. But this is still going to go on faster and faster. If you've got that sort of level of processing computers, they're going to start designing even better computers. So you cross a new threshold, it will go even faster. So it isn't the end of this accelerating curve, it's just a point where things really take off. And you have what's called the ultra-intelligent machine. The question is, where is this curve, the whole trend going beyond that singularity? There's two sorts of curves that look like this. There's what's called the exponential curve, which keeps on increasing faster and faster. And that's the one, you know, you invest your dollar at 10%, and next year it's worth $1.1, and after that it's worth $1.21, and after that $1.33, and so it goes on. That goes on forever, except in reality it can't, as we're now discovering. In fact, if you invested a dollar at 10% in the year 1000 AD, it would now be worth 10 trillion times the weight of the earth in gold. You know, can you imagine even laymen or paying out on that? Another 1,000 years invested $1, and it's worth more than the weight of the galaxy in gold. That's why any system based on the charging of interest has to collapse or suffer inflation to the same degree. So that's the exponential curve. It goes on forever. But there's another sort of curve, which is called the hyperbolic curve, which reaches a limit. And the evolutionary curve, it's hard to map these things out accurately because you have to find, you know, when exactly did this happen in evolution, which were the major points, and what were the major points in human society. But all the indications are that it's a hyperbolic curve, which means that there's a point in time somewhere where the curve goes infinitely steep. And that's what Terence McKenna was pointing out. Terence has been mentioned a couple of times here. Terence McKenna, who back in, whenever it was, the 70s, wasn't it? 75, wrote his book, The Invisible Landscape. He was looking at this from a slightly different point of view initially. He was looking at the I Ching and the sequence of the I Ching, and out of that developed this sort of weird-looking curve, which doesn't look anything interesting at all, except that it's fractal. So the curve is sort of like that. Nothing, you know, when you look at it, it has no interest whatsoever, except that it's fractal, which means you take this. The next section of the curve is like that. It's a repetition of this curve in a shorter time. And the next section of the curve is like that. It's the same curve repeating in faster and faster and faster time cycles. And his model, it was each one is 64 times faster. So this is 1/64 of the time before. But then what made this interesting is he started laying this curve against history. And you find things like this, there's a period here, say it was this period where there's a high point in, well, the high point, I should go back a step. He related this to newness, to change. He used the term novelty, the rate at which novelty, new things came into the world. So in times in which there was creativity. And this seemed to correlate, well, a particular peak with what's called the axial period in human history. The axial period is that time about 500 BC, when Greek culture was flourishing and the Buddha was around, there were, all over the world, there seemed to be this awakening of consciousness, which in completely different parts of the world that had hardly any connection. He found this also, if you lay that against history, this corresponded, the repetition corresponded to the 1960s, when there was this period of the beginning of another period of awakening around the world. And this curve is hyperbolic. It gets faster and faster and faster. It's approaching a limit. So it goes from thousands of years to hundreds of years to decades to years to hours to minutes. Where was this? And he experimented with this. He started sliding the curve up and down history. And obviously, here we're talking about a period of 100, 150, 200 years or so of history. There's a lot of leeway here, but when you get up here, it gets tighter and tighter. And he was trying to work out where the end of the curve was. And he eventually settled, actually for more personal reasons than anything else, on December the 22nd, 2012. He says he didn't know anything at all about the Mayan calendar at this stage. He discovered it later. But it's interesting, it was one day after the Mayan calendar completes its cycle. And this is a true singularity. Though he said, Terence was always a very open person to not get attached to his own beliefs or anything or reasoning. I remember him saying once, he said, it'll be interesting to see if anything does happen then. And I think the overall pattern is valid, whether that moment is there or not. I think this moment is probably quite a bit further in the future when all the curves tighten up on each other. But not that far in the future. I think it's probably within the next 50 years or so. And that may be the culmination of this period of that 2012 is the epicenter of. This accelerating curve is taking us towards somewhere else. It's what Teilhard de Chardin called the Omega Point. And it's interesting to be here talking at Omega on the Omega Point. Teilhard de Chardin was looking at evolution from the big picture. And when he started writing, he said, we don't quite know where human beings began. At that stage, people were looking for the missing link. This was about, where are we now? 70, he was in the, 30s, 40s? So we're talking 70 years ago, something like that. He was involved in the work on Peking Man, some of the early stuff looking at their history. And he said, but we can see where we're headed towards. And Daniel touched upon this, that when he's talking about the biosphere, the geosphere. What Teilhard de Chardin said is he saw phases of evolution. The first he called cosmogenesis, which is the birth of the universe, creating what he called the cosmosphere, which we would call the universe. And then out of that, out of matter, came biogenesis, the birth of life, and the biosphere of the planet. He also actually put in geogenesis, the creation of the Earth, and then the geosphere, which we call the Earth. Then there was biogenesis, the biosphere. Daniel added in the technosphere, although Teilhard de Chardin didn't see that, but he talked about the new sphere, which is the mind appearing on Earth. And then he saw this heading towards what he called Christogenesis. Remember, he was a Jesuit. He was both a sort of archaeologist, but also a Jesuit who's very firmly rooted in the Christian tradition, so he saw it in Christian terms. And the Christogenesis was when there was the awakening, basically, to our true spiritual inheritance, a global awakening. And that's what he called the Omega point, the point towards which evolution is heading. And he initially put this thousands of years in the future, thousands of years in the future. But he wasn't taking the acceleration into account. And it's interesting, towards the end of his life, he began to see this and started revising his model. When he saw what television was doing, he said, I think television, mass media like this, is going to bring the Omega point much, much closer. And then just before he died, the first computers came along. And he said, I think this is going to have something to do with the Omega point. And here we are. So he saw the Omega point as way in the future. I think it's in our own lifetimes somewhere. And the image that I have very much of all this is a spiral. It's like we are spiraling into something, each turn of the spiral happening faster and faster. And the Omega point is like this point to which we're spiraling towards. And we're out here somewhere at the moment. There's a few more spirals to go. But they're going to happen faster and faster, which means if that's the track we're on, then the whole of our future evolution is going to get collapsed into potentially our own lifetimes. And that evolution is not, we think of evolution as physical. We've moved beyond biological evolution. We moved out of that when we started developing science, tools, understanding. We started changing our world, changing culture. A whole new form of creativity was unleashed. And now I think what this crisis is doing is pushing us to beyond that form of creativity, external creativity. It's pushing us into the next stage, which is the waking up to who and what we truly are. And then there may be steps beyond that, which I want to touch upon, which are taking us into other realms, which are becoming quicker and quicker and quicker. And this all ties in with a general trend in evolution, which is a trend towards increasing intelligence. And I define intelligence as the processing and utilization of information. And this has been going on again since evolution really began. DNA is a wonderful information processor. We call memory system for life. You know, we all know how our own bodies are generated from the information contained in the DNA. And through sexual reproduction, through the development of brains and nervous systems, you can see life has been getting better and better at processing information. It's been getting more and more intelligent. And again, Teilhard de Chardin saw this. He called it the law of complexity consciousness. As the physical systems get more complex, so they become more conscious. And so as we move on, this law, if it keeps applying, we're going to become, the direction is becoming more conscious, more intelligent. And that's a trend in human development as well. We've not only developed all these material technologies, but there's been this whole thrust of information technology, beginning with writing, clay tablets, then on paper, and then printing, consolidated that, allowed us to mass produce our writings, and then radio, television, the internet. There's been this whole thrust towards better, more efficient information processing. And I see the next stage in that, and we now talk about, we live in the knowledge society. We have, through this information processing, access to knowledge like we've never had before. I'm sure we all are familiar with that, just the advent of things like Wikipedia over the last couple of years. I'm sure most of you access Wikipedia from time to time, probably, if you're like me, every day for one reason or another, accessing the internet. Want to find out something? Log on. You've got the answer in 30 seconds or whatever. I realized about 10 years ago I'd never have to go to a library again. Much as I love libraries, but what I used to do was when I was researching, I'd have this sort of little book and I'd note down, okay, I've got to find out that. What's the source of that? What's the figures for that? When did that happen? What date did that happen? And I'd either be sort of going to my own Encyclopedia Britannicas and things, looking things up, but the things I couldn't find, I then stack up, and maybe once every week or two, I go down to the university library and spend half a day in the library thumbing through, looking for the right book, and probably find about a third the things I was looking for. You know, now I want to find out something, I just sort of type it in, carry on doing what I'm doing, and 30 seconds later, there's the answer. So we have all this knowledge. But there's this progression, which I'm sure you've all heard about, which goes in data, information, knowledge, wisdom. What we don't have at the moment is a wisdom society. And that's what we need. It was Schumacher, the economist who wrote Small is Beautiful, said, humankind is now too clever to survive without wisdom. And wisdom, different ways of defining wisdom, I see it as this progression. Data is the basic units of, it's just data, it's the ones and zeros in a computer, it's, you know, the light coming in through the eye in visual perception. Information are the patterns in the data. The patterns in the data give us information. And then knowledge is that generalization of information to a broader area. You know, so we see a tree, we get the information about the tree, and we watch it through the seasons, we get, that's more information. We generalize that to knowledge about how a tree grows, how it functions. Wisdom is the next level beyond knowledge, and I see wisdom as discernment. It's discernment in terms of how do we use the knowledge we have. What is valuable knowledge? What is even correct knowledge? What knowledge stands the test of time? What knowledge is universal to all cultures? But particularly in these times, what knowledge is it appropriate to apply? You know, now we know how to modify the human genome. We know how to create completely new life forms. We have the knowledge. Is it wise to do so? But without wisdom, we just seem to go ahead doing things because they're possible, like climbing mountains because it was there, or we had to create new life forms because it was possible. It's there. So I see part of this time we're going through is about developing wisdom. So when we think of wisdom, wise, the wise ones, wise, we think of people in their later years of life who've lived through things and finally sussed out what's important. The wise ones in life are usually those who aren't chasing money or fame so much and probably are valuing human relationships and simpler lives. Or we think of the wise ones as the awakened ones, the enlightened ones, the wise ones through society in every culture, those people who've touched into that spiritual truth. And in the past, they've just been few and far between generally. They just cropped up here and there, and some we know about in history, probably many others we don't know about. But I think another part of the accelerating trend is that this awakening to wisdom is happening faster and faster and faster, and is happening in this time, which, as I said earlier, I think got triggered, this particular phase got triggered in the 60s. And many of us back then, we realized that, you know, dropping acid wasn't the way to do it. And the first phase, we all went off to India looking for the guru who had all the answers, who would enlighten us. And we had some great experiences and got enlightened for moments here and there. But I remember my teacher saying once, he said, you know, it's okay to sit out here in the Himalayas and have all these wonderful cosmic experiences. The real test is, he said, can you go back and stand in Times Square and not lose it? And I failed that test. Many times. But we've been exploring. There was, you know, we went from chasing gurus to those deep, intensive workshops, the Ests and all those things. But it's been moving and growing. I mean, when I started this, my own personal search in Cambridge, in England, there was the university bookstore was probably the second largest bookstore in England at the time. And up, there was one shelf in the sort of spiritual section which was on, you know, alternative spirituality. There was lots of books on Christianity and other established religions. And there was this one shelf which had books by people like Christopher Isherwood and Paul Brunton, people who are stepping beyond Aldous Huxley, who are stepping beyond the normal religious way of looking at spirituality. You know, now you go into any small town and you find bookstores devoted to this area, sadly called the New Age. It is true, but it has a whole reputation which I don't like to identify with. Here at Omega, wonderful bookstore. All those books, or 99% of them, are the result of us, not necessarily us in this room, but us on this journey, this collective journey. We are exploring different traditions, doing our own inner work, having realizations, piecing them together, feeling this insight is important, sharing it with others. We write a book about it. We read that book, I'm talking the collective we, assimilate it, some other new insight comes, another book, a video, an audio, a workshop emerges. What's happening is we are learning from each other. There's a collective spiritual awakening in which there's no single leader anymore. Some of you may remember Marilyn Ferguson's book, The Aquarian Conspiracy. Wonderful book in its time. One of the key ideas she was saying there was that this is a leaderless movement that's happening. There are no leaders. I heard, I don't know if it's true, the Dalai Lama said something to this effect. He said the next Buddha will not be a human being. It'll be a collective Buddha. And it's like we are becoming that awakened collective, teaching ourselves. And the internet, of course, is playing a greater and greater role in this. Through the internet now, we're beginning to really share our experiences. When it started, I'd say no one saw where it was going. And when I wrote The Global Brain 25 years ago, I had no idea what would happen. I thought it was just the sharing of information would link us together on a global level, because it was clear then that what was going to happen was the linking of computers. Now we're in that. And the next stage beyond that is the networking, the interaction, what they call Web 2.0, the fact we can participate in it, we can share, we're getting closer and closer to sharing our experiences with each other. What happens when we can really start sharing our awakening with each other? We can actually collectively start giving each other darshan, so to speak, through the internet. I mean, darshan is the Indian term for that direct transmission of awakening. That could be possible. Not could be possible, is possible. How does that happen? I mean, just last year, there was Eckhart Tolle on the Oprah Winfrey Show with that television series that interfaced with the internet, taking it to many, many people. I think we're going to see far more of that. That was like a step in that direction. I was talking to Michael Kraft yesterday about this, and he was pointing out that Eckhart Tolle isn't probably the best person for that. Because he's wonderful, and I think his books, his teaching, the way he works is so clear and right on. He's really touching the essence of what we need to be doing. But he's got this very sort of this style which is, and the silence, and which is wonderful in a workshop situation, but on television where you need this bang, 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 or else people are going to switch channels. What happens when we start getting people who can do the same thing with that sort of charismatic mode, who actually can transmit through television, through the net? This could happen faster and faster still. And the other trend that's happening in all of this is we are honing that spiritual wisdom. We are coming down to the essence. I was saying earlier how that sort of that essence over time gets dressed up. It's the whole process of truth decay that ends up with all these different religions and sects, all of whom seem to be saying totally different things, and they start fighting each other, having wars over which particular distortion of the truth is the correct one. What we're doing now is we are seeing through all these different clothing of that spiritual truth. We are seeing through it, gradually honing down to what is the real essential wisdom here. And as we do, it gets simpler and simpler and simpler. I remember, in my own journey, I was thinking, it's about higher states of consciousness, doing all this inner work, and maybe this lifetime I can finally break through into this something or other spectacular new consciousness. And realizing, no, it's just actually just letting go to actually being with what is. It's actually here. There's nowhere to go. And that's, even just by the agreement, then people going, in this room, that I feel is the cutting edge of where this whole collective spiritual search has been going the last few years, the last 5 years. And it's often characterized by the term non-dual teachings, which is a confusing label to some extent. But it represents the understanding that there is nowhere to go but being more here. And it's our trying to get somewhere, our seeking, our searching, that actually, in one way or another, keeps us disconnected from the real truth of who we are. It's also to do with seeing through the duality of self and the world. That this sense of self we've constructed is just that. It's a construct in our mind. Seems very, very real, and it is real. As far as everything else we construct in our mind is real. But the ultimate truth is there's just beingness, experience. And this is what I feel is the cutting edge of the whole collective awakening that's happening at the moment, getting simpler and simpler and simpler. Which means it gets easier and easier. Which fuels this whole thing about the spiritual awakening getting faster and faster and faster. And that's where I see we're heading towards as this spiral goes faster and faster. Or in Terence's terms, we go through these fractals, each one faster and faster. In fact, on his model, a year before we reach that point, there's this massive repetition of the axial period in the 60s happens again. It's coming up again a year before we get there. And then it will happen again a few weeks before we get there. Hold on tight. So, where's I going to go? I don't know. Actually, where I want to go is actually go out on a limb a bit and talk about something I don't normally talk about. I cut it out of my book, Waking Up in Time. It was the final chapter. I thought of including it as the untold chapter. I cut it out because I wanted to actually keep the book fairly reasonable and acceptable, even though it was quite, in its own way, challenged some thinking. And it's to do with where are, you know, what are the next turns in the spiral? I said our whole of our future evolution, it, waking up, becoming, quote, enlightened, whatever we want to call it, isn't the end. It's just the next loop in this spiral. And if you look at various traditions in the world, beyond that is, I don't know the best way to describe it, we could call it seeing through the illusion of space, time and matter. Seeing through the illusion that we are material beings. A sort of transcendence of this physical world. And thinking, well, how would that look collectively? And the image I have is like humanity is just this image of humanity is like points of light in space. And these points of light have been, over time, growing in numbers. Each point of light is like one human consciousness. We've been growing in numbers, this population explosion, which thankfully is now beginning to taper off as we reach the limits. But also each of those points of light getting brighter. And as we get brighter, also the boundaries between them beginning to dissolve. Until we just become one single light, sort of planetary consciousness, a planetary awakening of human consciousness. And I don't know what that looks like, but I just feel that feels like the direction we're headed. And somehow in that collectivized awakening, collectively stepping out of the illusion that we are material beings. I mean, the phrase that comes up is a collective near-death experience, but it isn't a near-death experience, it's a collective rebirth. Being collectively reborn. And that our whole history has been building up to this point. Which suggests that if that is the direction of the evolution of intelligence, of consciousness, towards that collective coming together, that is probably true for every intelligent species throughout the universe. I think so much when we start thinking of other intelligences, we so easily get stuck in our particular way of looking at the world. And we think they must be like we are, a bit more advanced than our current technology. Any other beings that have got past this bottleneck, this point where the crisis happens and you have to wake up, is going to be angelic compared to us. The idea they're going to be going around with lasers zapping people. It's just a projection of our own very limited, somewhat violent, aggressive mode of consciousness that we got stuck in. We're just projecting that onto others. I think other intelligences in the universe will have moved into something completely different, which says, I think if there is contact, it's much more likely to be on some inner realm than some external meeting at an Air Force base, which may happen, but there's evidence, there's strange things going on, but I think the real contact is at another level. And that point was what I called the white hole in time in my book, The White Hole in Time, which is now republished as Waking Up in Time, which is actually in the bookstores here. And the idea of the white hole in time came from a parallel with a black hole in space. A black hole, we've all heard the term, a black hole is the end of the evolution of matter in a star. In a star that's sufficiently massive. What happens is a star like our own sun is fueled by hydrogen. It's burning hydrogen. And it's doing that for 10 billion years or so. We're about halfway through the life of our sun. It's burning hydrogen. And it burns it into helium. This nuclear fusion happens. When all the hydrogen is burnt up, it goes through another stage of helium burning. And the helium fuses, and I forget now the exact sequence, but it goes through nickel, silicon, carbon. There's various stages, but I forget the exact order. But each one happens much faster. Like the helium burning happens in millions of years. So it's a short phase. And the next stage happens faster still. And the next stage happens faster still. And it starts speeding up. And then the final stage is when it can't go any further. And it's like the fire goes out and the star collapses under its own weight. And then you have this supernova explosion. As it collapses, it just explodes in light. And more light is produced in that period. And the sort of the flash, people see it, the glow lasting for years in the sky, the flash happens in hours or days as the star finally collapses. There's more light produced in those hours and days than through the whole history of the star's life. This huge explosion of light, which have, you know, people recorded over the ages, these huge spots, which have been bright enough in history to actually light up the sky at night as if it were not quite daylight, but bright enough to read by at night. They're so bright. And we're now spotting them out in distant universe. And then, behind is left this condensed matter, so condensed that light can't escape, and that's a black hole. And that then just sits there. As we now understand, very, very slowly evaporating, but also pulling in other masses. And who knows exactly what happens. But the point is, you've got this, coming back to the black hole is a singularity in the evolution of a star. And then when it reaches it, there's this new level. It continues, but in a stable form. The acceleration is over. And so I started thinking, well, is that the direction of the evolution of consciousness? Heading towards this point, which we seem to be this acceleration which is going on, which is undeniable. And if that, which is now we see in our own lives, and if that acceleration of awakening is taking us through to the ultimate end of our evolution as an intelligence, then is there something equivalent to an explosion of the light of consciousness? It just seems possible. That's what I called a white hole in time. Beyond that, we become something totally different, into a level of stability, a totally different form of existence, maybe no longer incarnated in physical bodies, who knows? Something like that. And the question is, I probably see that as where we are headed. The question is, do we get there this time? Because with a star only gets there if it's sufficiently massive. It won't happen to our sun, it's too small. It happens to stars that are about 3.5 times heavier than our sun. Our sun will just end up as a dwarf and continue glowing and eventually die out. But if it's sufficiently massive, that's what happens. So it seems to me this is what happens to the evolution of intelligence. If it wouldn't be sufficiently massive, it would be if it were sufficiently conscious for that to happen. If it doesn't happen, you have a curve coming up like this, heading towards, we call it, quote, 2012 in our times. And then we don't wake up sufficiently. We don't manage the crisis well enough. We don't develop the wisdom to really see us through. And we have some sort of setback. We drop down again. A minor setback would just be the collapse of Western civilization. Yeah. That would be the first step. And I say minor in the big, it'd be major for us, but not the end of, you know, all civilizations have collapsed. You know, Toynbee charted something like 20 different civilizations, all of which have ended. The Greeks, the Romans, Chinese dynasties, they all come to an end. There's no reason to think that Western civilization is the one that's going to last forever. In fact, there's every reason to see it cannot go on. And we are beginning to see that. Maybe we're living through the beginning of the falling apart of Western civilization. But that doesn't mean the end of humanity. It doesn't even mean the end of us. I mean, we saw the Soviet Union collapse. Most of the people in the Soviet Union are still alive. They went through some hard times, still going through hard times. Things changed a lot. It doesn't mean the end, but it's a setback. And if that's where what it was, at the end of Western civilization, there'd be a period of who knows what, maybe chaos and regrouping. But a lot of the technology we have would still be there, a lot of the knowledge would still be there. Hopefully a lot of the spiritual awakening that's happening would still be there. And so what we'd start off again on that. We'd continue and we'd start accelerating again. Or it might be a much bigger, you know, all that's left of humanity might be, you know, some indigenous peoples who managed to survive global warming. But then that same curve is there, that force towards acceleration is still there, taking us up again towards that asymptote, that point of singularity. It still lies ahead of us. The acceleration is going to keep on taking us towards that point. Even if we, you know, had such a major setback that humanity became extinct, which is possible, I don't think it's very likely. It is possible. You could think of various scenarios whereby, you know, we are the last generations to live on this planet. There's evolution, you know, 1 million years' time, 10 million years' time, other species will have evolved, intelligence will keep evolving, something we can't imagine what, if it starts manipulating the world. dolphins grow their thumbs back? I hope not. We'd be on this same curve. This is inevitable. So whether we reach it this time or another time, whether that one collapses, whether we do, I think, is really up to us. And this is what Corinne was talking about yesterday. We have the choice. We collectively have the choice about how, what happens at this particular time in history that we're now in. This period is, I like John's phrase yesterday, of transformation and renewal. Which is renewal, John was saying yesterday. And it really does mean us, me, each of us. And I touched on earlier how, you know, the economic crisis, we're all involved in that in a way. I mean, who of you is entirely without any inkling of greed? Only if you know, you're also stuck in the look at me, I'm so good, I'm so enlightened. If you know, if you're into the pride, if you've got through greed but haven't yet got through pride, then please stand up now. Various teachings say that pride is the last thing to go. But the point is, it's easy to fall into they must change. Those greedy bankers must change. Those self-centered, power-driven, lying politicians must change. You know, the corporate business must change. All those people, you know, consuming must change. Those polluters must change. It's always they must change. I'm exaggerating a bit, but it's easy to fall into, you know, the world is falling apart and it's the fault of what's happening out there. And remember, in the eyes of everybody else, we're one of them. And the only person we truly have responsibility for is our own self. We can wish to see others awaken. We can wish to see others become less self-centered, more compassionate, more loving. We can wish to see that, and that's great, and we can encourage that. We can do what we can to help other people from our own experience, but ultimately the only person we really have responsibility for changing is ourselves. So it comes back to how do we engage in that awakening process? We're probably all engaged in it. How do we further that? How do we facilitate that in ourselves? And that's why I see this whole honing of spirituality is happening, the learning from each other is fueling that. The fact it's getting simpler and simpler. How do we work with that? And that's a personal question for each of us. For me, it's meditation is a really important path. And I see that's going to be a crucial thing in the future. Because for me, it's through meditation that we actually can begin to still the mind and get in touch with both with our essence, with what we really are, touch into that spiritual dimension, and also begin to see the stuff we carry around that we need to work with. Our blocks, our patterns, the ways of thinking that aren't useful. As the mind settles down, we can begin to see more clearly that stuff that's going on. I was about to finish in about 2 minutes, so where timing is perfect, yeah. That's more or less it anyway. In fact, I just produced a CD which is in the store. It's called The 2012 Mind Shift. It's actually got 5 different meditations which I think are useful for our own awakening and seeing ourselves through this critical time. So let's pause here let's have a break, let's say 10 minutes, and then we can go into questions, dialogue, etc.